So why do certain foods become incredibly popular, trendy, like bacon or Greek yogurt or cupcakes? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll find out this hour when we talk with the author of The Tastemakers, Why We Are Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. We will welcome your questions. And what is your favorite food of today? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Would you stand in a long line to buy a certain food item like that cronut in New York? What is the food fad that intrigues you the most? We are talking this hour with David Sachs. He is a writer specializing in business and food. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, Bloomberg Business Week, and other publications. Author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what pulled you into studying food trends?
You know, it was a mixture of seeing, I guess, a bit behind the scenes of the food business as I was doing some reporting for magazines like Business Week, and seeing how that business really works to shape your sense of taste. But it was also, you know, the phenomenon of going out for dinner here in Toronto, where I live. And one year, there are absolutely no places in town that serve Baja-style fish tacos, and you have to sort of search for them after coming back from vacation in Mexico. And then 2 years later, they're everywhere. They're on every menu. They're in every bar. There's five food trucks dedicated to them. They sell them at the Blue Jays games. And so it's this head-scratching thing of, wait a minute, how did this get here? How did foods like this all of a sudden become so popular that they're omnipresent? And why, you know, why does that happen? And what are the forces at play?
That's fascinating. How did the fish taco become everywhere?
You know, it was, I think, something that trickled up for here in Toronto, or probably similarly in Wisconsin, you know, through culture in California and you know, slowly moving up the West Coast until it sort of arrived here. But I think there was this cultural moment at a certain point where, you know, it was the recession. Restaurants were looking for things that were relatively inexpensive to do, but, you know, could generate some buzz. And the fish taco was basically a way of repurposing, you know, fish and chips of fried fish, but making it sort of sexy. And there were a number of restaurants that that were very prominent, kind of, I call them the hipster taquerias at the time, places like Big Star in Chicago, which took Mexican food out of its traditional context and, you know, put it to a hip-hop soundtrack, basically. And so they were able to sell tacos and Mexican food with greater sex appeal and for, you know, a bigger profit margin. And the fish taco was one of the top sellers in all these restaurants. If you speak to any of these kind of cool taco places, and I'm sure there's some in Madison and Milwaukee, you know, the fish taco is their number one seller. It's not the carnitas. It's not the taco al pastor. It's the fish taco, because it's such a, it takes something that's very familiar, and then anyone could put any spin on it. And I think that's something that you see with the big successful trends like cupcakes or bacon, is that they're almost a blank slate for any sort of cultural or social or artistic expression that people want to do. You can do high-end fish tacos. You can do low-end fish tacos. You can do organic fish tacos. You can do local fish tacos with, you know, seasonal whitefish from the Great Lakes. Or you could do, you know, Asian-style fish tacos with ahi tuna and you know, a wasabi glaze.
Yes.
And so you saw this with other big trends, where the more places that that food can go into, the more it can sort of transform and be reborn and take on another narrative, the bigger it's going to get.
Well, so are the chefs at these, you know, trendy restaurants the tastemakers?
They are. I mean, you know, The Tastemakers is the title I picked for the book. It really is sort of a broad term that defines anyone who has the power to influence your sense of taste and what you're eating, anyone with the power to create or grow a trend. So I think chefs are the most obvious and the most visible. You know, a top chef in a city or nationally, if they create a successful dish or they have a very successful restaurant, not only does it affect the people who eat in that restaurant and pay to go visit there, but it affects everyone who reads about that restaurant, other chefs who hear about that restaurant or eat there and then go emulate those dishes and those flavors in their own restaurants, whether it's within the same city or elsewhere. And then anyone who reads about it in the media, on social media, and, you know, Instagrams a photo of that fish taco, which gets picked up by a friend of theirs in Singapore who then, you know, starts a fish taco truck in Singapore, and so on and so forth. But there are other tastemakers as well. There are, you know, the members of the media who are the ones that are really sort of the megaphones for this and who take the message of a trend and amplify it so it reaches the mass market quicker. There are people in agriculture who are creating things in a very different way. They're developing new breeds of plants. They're developing new breeds of livestock that could then provide the basis for food trends later on, chef-driven trends, or, you know, just the type of apples that you're buying at your local supermarket. And then there are the people who work behind the scenes of the food industry in marketing and, you know, distribution. So they might be the buyer for Whole Foods of the Midwest region who really decides, hey, these are the 500 new products that we're going to push this year. And, you know, 100 of them involve chia seeds because I really believe this will be the next thing. And so once it enters somewhere like Whole Foods, it's inevitable until, you know, Costco or Walmart's going to pick it up a year or two down the line.
Were you saying that the food buyers say that chia seeds will be the next big thing, or are you saying that?
Well, you know, I it's interesting. When I was researching the book, I guess about 2 years ago, you know, I was talking to all these people who were in the business of selling chia and growing chia and putting chia into different products, and it was sort of the start of them getting momentum of it being the next big thing. Well, it's arrived. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, there's Kashi cereal with chia, and you can buy huge things of chia at Costco. It's gone mainstream very quickly and in a very big way. So it's here. And it's just a question of how long it's going to stay around.
Yeah. Well, tell us the story of the cupcake. Now we have a little mall in Madison that has two different cupcake stores, and, you know, these specialty cupcake stores are all over the place.
They're called cupcakeries. Actually a new term. It is a term of the era we live in, the 21st century word. The cupcake is an interesting thing. You know, I say it's three sort of factors: Sex in the City, 9/11, and social media. So the cupcake is something that we all recall from our childhood as what you would get at your birthday or when someone in your class would have a birthday at school, mm-hmm. and it was a very innocent, homemade, childlike treat. Maybe the local bakery would serve them as well, usually in chocolate or vanilla. Something happened to the cupcake in the mid-1990s. A bakery in New York opened up called the Magnolia Bakery, and they didn't even make cupcakes at first. They made them, you know, by chance one time when they had leftover cake batter, but they proved quite popular. And they were these classic homespun cupcakes, but, you know, made with great care and a big flourish of icing, and they were beautiful, and they stocked them in the shop window. And it was in the West Village of Manhattan, which is a very fashionable, trendy area. A lot of people who work in media work there, who work in fashion live there, you know, the beautiful people. And word got around that the cupcake was the thing to get, and people started lining up for these cupcakes. Well, for a couple years, this one place, Magnolia Bakery, was a magnet for cupcakes, and it inspired a few other cupcake bakeries in and around sort of wealthy areas of Manhattan, but it wasn't anything that went large. And then a couple things happened. You had Sex in the City film very beginning of an episode there, 1 20-second shot where the two main characters, Carrie and Miranda, are sitting out front talking about someone that Carrie's dating and eating cupcakes. And that shot was really the only time in the show ever that there was cupcakes. They never mentioned the Magnolia Bakery, but it became this cultural touchstone for identifying and changing the narrative of cupcakes from something that kids would eat to something that was associated with Sex and the City and everything that that was about, fashion, aspiration, sex, indulgence. You know, the cupcake was cool. The cupcake became, along with cosmopolitan martinis and $500 pairs of shoes, you know, an icon of everything that show represented. And that show was wildly popular. So there were tours of Sex and the City that would go and stop at Magnolia Bakery and hand out cupcakes. And the media started picking up on this and writing about it. And so the word started spreading, you know, both nationally and internationally. Every time that Sex and the City was written about, or the Sex and the City tour was written about, it would mention cupcakes. You have to go get a cupcake. This is where they got them. And then, you know, 2001 came around and September 11th happened, and the nation was plunged both into recession and this this climate of fear and depression. And when that happens, you know, the trends that tend to emerge are comfort food trends. Yeah. People go from experimenting with bold, interesting international flavors and you know, crazy chef ideas to things like macaroni and cheese and hamburgers and grilled cheese because they want things that are familiar, that are comforting, that let them know that everything's okay and that the world is secure. And what could be a more comforting memory of the best times in your life than a cupcake? Again, the highlight of childhood, you know, the high point of any kid's life is that couple days a year when you get to eat cupcakes. And so there was this cultural moment, there was this change of the narrative which made them permissible for adults to eat this handheld small indulgence. And then the third factor is the rise of the internet and social media. Cupcakes took off in the early 2000s, and that was right around the time when the internet was really gaining this speed. Broadband penetration was going across the country and around the world. The world of blogs and the blogosphere started popping up. So you had, you know, at first dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of dedicated baking and cupcake blogs across the world where people were posting pictures of the cupcakes they were making or cupcakes they were buying, sharing them with other people who would then attempt those recipes and one-up them and so on and so forth. And that was only built upon by Facebook, which made it easier for them to be shared amongst a specific circle of your friends, and Twitter, where it just sort of blew up, and Instagram and Pinterest. And so the cupcake boom really grew off these, and what that changed is that a food trend went from something that happened when you read about it in a magazine or a newspaper, and then you went to that place and sort of tasted it, and maybe you would go and replicate it, to something that was viral. So there are cupcake shops now all over the world. There are cupcake shops in Pakistan. There are cupcake shops in Rwanda. There are cupcake shops in Paraguay. And it's not as though these people flew to New York and ate at the Magnolia Bakery, or flew to Dubai and ate at the Magnolia Bakery there and then replicated it. Mm-hmm. They saw it on the internet. And they went and researched on the internet all these recipes and looked at all these different photos and made them themselves and emulated their shops in the same style and way. And you can see through the photos that they post online the evolution of how it goes. You know, at first this woman in Paraguay is making these cupcakes that look like little chocolate muffins, a very sort of classic, almost easy bake muffin cupcake. Mm-hmm. And by the end, they're like, you know, entire scenes from Angry Birds enacted in reenacted in cupcakes, all of which she just saw online and then started working and taking more ideas from other people around the world. And so the virality of it just allows trends to grow quicker and bigger today than it ever did. I like to say that the cupcake trend was, you know, the first food trend of the 21st century, the food trend that will define food trends from here on in, because it was so viral.
We are talking about why we are crazy for cupcakes and other food trends with David Sachs, who is author of The Tastemakers. We'll talk about what might replace the cupcake as the big food trend, some of the other popular food fads or food trends that are out there, like bacon. There's a piece of bacon on a cupcake on the cover of David Sachs's book. And we wonder what food trends or fads you are following. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll also find out how we tire of certain food fads, like why did we finally get fed up with fondue? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with David Sachs, author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue, plus Baconomics, superfoods, and other secrets from the world of food trends. We welcome your questions and your thoughts about food trends and whether or not there's a certain food that's popular right now that you're crazy about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, well, we heard the story of why we are crazy for cupcakes and all of the factors that went into its incredible rise in popularity. What about David Sachs? Why did we love fondue way back when? That was big in the 70s, I seem to recall.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, there's also still the Melting Pot restaurant, but maybe that's just the Midwest. We still
have
that.
You know, I actually write about the Melting Pot in the book. My final chapter is sort of what happens when a food isn't trendy. And I went to the Melting Pot's headquarters in Tampa. Of all places, the Melting Pot is actually a Florida chain.
You would
think that it's a Wisconsin chain. They get all their cheese from Wisconsin, Emmy Rothkass, but I know I've mispronounced that terribly, but they began in Tampa, interestingly, when the fondue trend was on its way out. So fondue was something that, you know, it's a very traditional Swiss food, cheese fondue, from the area of in the Swiss Alps called Neuchâtel, which is on the French border. And it became popular in America in the 1950s and 60s, really at this restaurant in New York City called Chalet Suisse, which was a very traditional Swiss restaurant. And it was sort of the high-end, you know, tastemaker. Its owner, Conrad Egli, and its chefs, Erwin Herger, were the tastemakers of their day. You have to remember that this was a time post-war when the idea of European sophistication of continental cooking was really the height of sophistication. We didn't have all the international influences, Mexican, Spanish, Japanese, Thai, that we do today. There were Chinese restaurants and tacos coming in, but it wasn't, you know, that wasn't where people spent the big bucks. And so fondue slowly became something that was popular in restaurants, and there were sort of fondue restaurants around, and recipes came out, and there were books. But it was in the 1960s with the advent of home fondue sets and suburbanization, and really, I think, the sexual revolution, where you had the birth of the fondue party.
The sexual resolution?
It was, you know, when you think about the fondue party, it was not, mom and dad and the kids and the grandparents.
It was the swingers.
Yeah, exactly. It was, it was the swinging 60s transplanted to the suburban setting. It was intimacy and shared dishes and low candlelight. The idea of the fondue party came from something called the Fondue Cookbook, which was this place in Boston called the Pot Shop, which is one of the early importers of fondue sets. Julia Child's got her fondue set there. And, you know, it's a manual for how to throw a fondue party, and it's just filled with terrible, really cheesy sexual innuendos. It should be, the candle should be low, the lighting should be low enough that the flicker of the candle should illuminate the faces of strangers to make them into friends, and
so on
and so forth. But, you know, this was at a time when the pill was coming out, when people's inhibitions around even basic things such as sharing food between each other was being lowered as America was relaxing more. And the fondue party provided a very accessible, inexpensive way to add sophistication to, you know, your suburban living room. Even if it didn't end up in, you know, the wild swinging parties. It still provided some type of different, slightly exotic experience. And so, you know, the fondue party is really what made it this big trend, and especially chocolate fondue later on. There was also meat fondue and seafood fondue. And why it died out was a number of different factors. Trends die or trends move on because they often run out of steam. There's only so many ways to reinvent something like fondue and to present it in a different way. And here in North America, we're constantly looking for the next thing. We don't have, you know, a cuisine that we've been doing for thousands of years like they do in Italy or Switzerland. We're, you know, a nation of immigrants, and we're always looking for new ideas and innovation. And so we tire of things. Trends are also, you know, knocked off by other trends. In fondue's case, you know, the diet trends of the late 1970s and 80s, which were low fat and low carbohydrate, really, you know, was disastrous for fondue, which is basically carbohydrates dipped in fat, which is, you know, why it's delicious. But, you know, everything from the Atkins diet to the low fat, high fiber diet was very bad for fondue. And then there were other cultural trends. You know, one of the things that I read about, and it just sort of hinted at it, but it made a lot of sense when you think about fondue parties, is the rise of HIV and AIDS in the early 1980s.
Put a damper on the sexual revolution.
You know, people didn't know anything about this disease. It was a plague that was killing a lot of people. And suddenly the idea of sharing a communal dish and everybody sort of putting the same fork in and having this very intimate shared experience became unpalatable because it was a time, you know, when people were very worried about these things. It was terrifying in a way. And so the freedom of the sexual revolution that the fondue party had taken off with really died with that. But that doesn't mean that it won't come back, that fondue is dead. The charms of eating fondue are still there, especially in winter in places like, you know, Wisconsin or here in Ontario.
In fact, let me add that Katie on Twitter says, I still love fondue. Maybe it's a Wisconsin thing. Hashtag cheese. So
cheese and beer, yeah. And there are now a lot of, you know, hip cheese and beer fondues that are coming out. I think of the craft beer movement is...
Well, that's huge here.
Itself with fondue. So if anywhere is going to be, you know, pushing the boundaries on it, I'm sure it's Wisconsin.
Well, so what is, I mean, the cupcake is huge still, but I mean, it's going to probably fade a little bit. What is the next big thing?
In terms of desserts or pastry?
Well, the one that might even approach the popularity of the cupcake.
Yeah. It's tough to say. I, you know, people have said it's going to be donuts, and I think that's probably the most likely contender, although donuts are much harder to make at home.
How about the cronut, that cronut thing?
The cronut is more of, you know, a fad. I think it was something that was very big last year. It was novel. It was interesting. It was sort of decadent. It grabbed a lot of headlines. But, you know, once you've had it a couple of times, you get it. It makes sense. It's nothing that anyone's ever going to make at home because it's too complicated and difficult. And, you know, a lot of the places that I saw that were start making them, you know, here in Toronto, for instance, did it for, you know, those couple months last summer when the cronut was grabbing headlines, and have since moved on because people got it, they tried it, and they
it
said,
wasn't
okay,
that great.
Check this off my list.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of talk about pie, but pie lacks a certain sex appeal, and it's not something that you can have individual portions of very easily in a very good way. There's too much of a crust to filling ratio, I think. So it remains to be seen. It could be brownies. It could be chocolate chip cookies. You know, generally, it's going to be something that's familiar, that is given a slightly new twist and done in a way that's really interesting. So I think you're seeing that with donuts a lot. You know, the resurrection of donuts from chains like Dunkin' Donuts, which really kind of mass-produced them and took a lot of the zeal out of them. Or it could be things like, you know, chocolate chip cookies or maybe croissants, but there's no contender leading the pack right now and sort of jumping ahead in the same way.
We are talking with David Sacks. He is author of The Taste Makers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. We're talking about why certain foods or trends fall in or out of favor. And we're welcoming your questions for him, any examples you might have. Is there a certain food you're crazy about right now? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jeff in Greenville emails, I follow another aspect of food trends, the local food movement. I try to buy local food, and I have a large, large garden as well as my own chickens. I raise about 100 meat birds per year, and I have a couple dozen layers. Well, there we go. That sounds like a food trend to me, David.
Yeah, certainly. You know, the local food trend, along with the organic food trend, is a really interesting example of the power of food trends. Because these were originally sort of political ideals that people had, for decades. The organic food movement goes back to really around the time of, the 1930s and 40s when colonial officials, a number of them from who were British colonial officials who were working in India, saw the traditional farming practices there and how it was better for the soil than modern sort of agriculture and fertilizers, and really tried to convince people to pick this up. And people have been, greens and, let's say, hippies have been sort of touting that for decades, as well as local. The idea that you should economically support local farmers, but also that it reduces the carbon footprint. And people didn't really care about that for a while. But when it became a food trend, when it became something that the best chefs were doing, and suddenly every cool restaurant that you went to in Madison or Milwaukee mm-hmm. or Wisconsin or New York or Toronto or wherever touted our ramps are local, they're seasonal, we only serve local seasonal things, we're a 100-mile restaurant and so forth. When it became de rigueur for anyone cooking a dinner party to talk about that and it became sort of that mainstream taste, that's when the actual market for organics and local food started taking off and filtering into the mainstream of the food world, not just kind of the high end. So that's when Walmart started selling organics, and chains like Chipotle started boasting about how they source locally for their different regions. And that's, that's the other thing about food trends. Yeah, they're fun and they're quirky and whatever, but they carry a tremendous economic and political weight.
Let's talk a little bit about the food trucks or food carts that we're seeing more and more, certainly in Madison. They've been around a long time on our University of Wisconsin campus, but now they're also in my neighborhood, and they move around to different neighborhoods throughout the week, so people can frequent the food trucks. Are food trucks or carts a food trend in themselves?
They are. Food trends sometimes take the model or take the form of economic models or sort of the types of restaurants or the types of food service we're seeing. So it may not be something specifically edible as much as a way of eating it. But the local organic thing is kind of a good example of that. And they are, they're a tremendous trend. A great example of how quickly and how broadly great ideas, which really food trends are at the end of the day, it's an edible idea, really how quickly they spread. I have a friend who teaches at the University of Wisconsin, Tony Michaels, Professor Tony Michaels, I hope he's listening, who's from California. And so, for years he was living there, he's saying, oh gosh, I really miss taco trucks, I miss food trucks, because it is a thing that existed in California for a number of years, largely, Mexican and Latin American food trucks. And in the past couple of years, he's spoken to me about how they're blooming in Madison as well. And now there's tremendous choice and opportunity for people who are eating. But, fundamentally at the core of the food truck revolution is not so much about food, but it's about, economics. This opened up the restaurant business and the food business to a whole new group of chefs and cooks who previously would have been scared off by opening the restaurant or opening a store because of the costs involved, hundreds of thousands of dollars to sort of start a new bakery or open a new restaurant. Whereas for tens of thousands of dollars, one could take a food truck and roll out a concept and test out an audience. And so that's why you've seen their tremendous growth. Yes, they're trendy. Yes, they attract a crowd. But more than that, they just make economic sense for someone entering the food business. And what's great about it is because there's a lower barrier to entry, it allows people to experiment with bolder, more interesting concepts, especially because they have to draw people out of their homes and offices and stand on the street. And, you know, you don't have the conveniences of a restaurant. And so you really need to capture them with something imaginative, which is why you don't see a lot of, just plain old tuna sandwiches being
right.
sold out of food trucks. It's a wasabi tuna sriracha sandwich with, you know, crab cakes in the middle, and it's served between two waffles or something.
Right,
like that.
Right. Let's go to Wendy in Oconomowoc next. Hello, Wendy.
Hello. Hi. I've been eating a lot of nut butters, like almond butter, cashew butter. That's become very popular, and doing them myself, you know, grinding them up myself so that I'm not using so many processed oils and using them in, like, salad dressings and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it works really well, and they're very nutritious.
Thank you for sharing, Wendy. That's true. I never heard of almond butter not too long ago, and now I get it all the time. And Wendy makes it herself. What do you think of that, David?
Yeah, it's something that really came out of sort of the health and diet trend world. The raw food movement is really based on nut butters and nut purees, because if you don't have them, you know, you're not really getting any protein if you're a raw foodie, which is a prominent diet trend that's grown in recent years. And then the health trend of the moment, which is protein. People mm-hmm. can't get enough protein. Protein's really big. So things like chia seeds have grown on the fact that they have protein in them, or Greek yogurt is a tremendous example. It's very high in protein, and people really want that without necessarily eating steaks and chicken. And so you've seen the rise of nut butters now. There's, again, once it was something that you would have to get in sort of a hippie health food store that, you know, was also selling natural remedies, and now you'll find it. There's brands and brands of not just, you know, different organic natural peanut butters, but almond butters, cashew butters, coconut butters, every sort of nut butter that you can imagine in all sorts of different flavors and permutations.
Well, we'll talk more about Greek yogurt. That truly does seem to be everywhere, commercial after commercial after commercial. And maybe not nut butters, let's talk about butter. That maybe is not in the book, but the pendulum is swinging in our food world when it comes from people who are using different oils or margarine. Now butter is back to some extent. And we welcome your thoughts, your questions for David Sacks. He is the author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. What food trends or fads would you like to talk about? Are you crazy about a certain food right now? How about kale chips? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So do you ever wonder why certain foods become incredibly popular and others fall out of favor or flavor? We are talking about food fads, food trends, and welcoming your thoughts and questions. Maybe some of your favorite food trends. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, what's with yogurt, especially Greek yogurt, David? You mentioned that it's being high in protein has helped it, but I'm thinking back way, way back when my family had a yogurt maker, and hardly anybody in the neighborhood would, you know, even ate yogurt, let alone made their own yogurt. And it kind of was on a cycle. It seemed yogurt was big, and then it wasn't, and then it was big, and then it wasn't, and now it's huge.
Yeah. You know, you got to think of it like fashion, right? Trends, I mean, as much as it's about feeding ourselves and fuel for our body, they are still an expression of culture. And, you know, when you think about fashion, you know, big shirts are in the season, then they go skinnier, then they go big. It's like mm-hmm. on this cycle, you can just sort of chart it and say, okay, it was what was big in the 1990s? Well, that's going to be big now. We're all going to be wearing oversized overalls in a year or something like that. And so, you know, a similar thing happens with food. Yogurt is, you know, a staple of our diet. It's kind of the thing we have for breakfast most often. And so it constantly needs to evolve to find new ways get us excited about it. And so it worked through this cycle where, you know, you had that yogurt maker and it was probably very sour and watery. It was kind of a hippie thing to do in the 1970s. And then as the 80s came around, yogurt got very big as the low-fat revolution was happening and everyone was making low-fat yogurts. The frozen yogurt trend came along with chains like PCBY, where they would blend these pucks of frozen yogurt with frozen fruit, and you know, you can pick all your different combinations. But you know, with most trends in North America, what you see happen is, you know, as it starts working its way out from individuals making it or small places or restaurants to the supermarket and larger companies and larger chains, they look for different ways to capture market share, and so they'll offer more flavors and more packages and more formats and more additives is generally what happens to it. And yogurt got, no pun intended, watered down. I mean, it was, you know, it was like cappuccino caramel flavored, frappuccino milkshake yogurt in a squeeze pack for kids that straps onto your bike helmet or something. Yogurt started off as this very virtuous, healthy thing and ended up being just another delivery system for corn syrup and sugar. And so people kind of, you know, we're sick of it, and Greek yogurt, which had always existed, it's the base for something like tzatziki, and it's really just plain yogurt with the water drained out of it, with, you know, without the whey. Started becoming very popular in sort of the 2006, 2007, 2008, in and around New York, where there is a large Greek population, and a couple of Greek brands were really, you know, from Greece, we're pushing this product as something healthy and almost like a reset of yogurt 101. And it took off because it was high in protein, it could be low in fat, and our concerns about fat were diminishing as it was growing. But it also was great because it worked in all sorts of different ways. You could do frozen Greek yogurt. You could do Greek yogurt and mix it up into your cereal as you would other yogurts. But you could also use it in salad dressings. You could use it in sauces. I mean, I remember buying this stuff when I lived in New York the first time, just plain Greek yogurt. And I would use it in everything. I would use it for desserts. I would use it with pancakes. I would use it to make a sauce, a sort of cream sauce. I would use it with pasta. It was this miraculous substance. It could go in all these different directions. And because it could do that, it had so many tentacles to sort of latch onto part of the food world and grow as a trend. But as you see now with Greek yogurt, which let's just call it yogurt because you can't even buy the other stuff in the store, again, people need new ways to sell it. They need to grow their market share. They need to grow their stock prices. And so now you're seeing the, you know, mocha cappuccino, caramel-flavored Greek yogurt snack bars and cereals, and it's become watered down. It's becoming diluted. And so, you know, what's going to be the next wave of yogurt? Will it be, Lebanese-style kefir or, Indian-style raita or who knows, right? People have talked about Australian yogurt or Icelandic yogurt or goat yogurt or water buffalo yogurt. Yogurt will always have yogurt. It's just going to have different names and different sort of permutations. And that's what pushes innovation in the food world. People aren't happy to just rest on the laurels of plain yogurt.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about low fat. Now, what about high fat? Studies are coming out just now saying, well, you know what, butter's better, and coconut oil saturated fat is better. Is that pendulum going to swing back?
Yeah, you know, one of the trends I think the trend that's the most pervasive and the trend that really has the most power, but also the most confusion and danger around it, are health and diet trends. Mm-hmm. Because, we're still grappling with the research of what to eat and its causes with us. And there's certain things that we know, you know, way too much sugar isn't good for us, way too much salt isn't good for us, you know, way too much alcohol and cigarettes aren't good for us. But what's the right proportion of protein and fat and meat? Often we'll take studies and even preliminary conclusions become the basis for these huge health and diet trends because the press picks up on them and people see them as an opportunity to sell things. And that's what happened with the low-fat trend, which really started sort of in the late 70s and grew huge in the 1980s when everything was low-fat and everybody was cooking egg white omelets and margarine. I mean, God, that was awful. eating tasteless, dry, boneless, skinless chicken breast and extra lean meat. I mean, people were breeding animals to be these scrawny, lean things and, you know, throwing out brisket, which was just a sin. But as the pendulum has swung back, now we're all embracing butter. Oh gosh, you know, forget about margarine. You know, butter is the best thing for you, and you know, because it doesn't have trans fats, it's natural, and we should all be eating, you know, higher fat cuts of meat in butter. And so the pendulum does swing. I think, thank God for that, as someone who loves butter and loves real flavorful things. But you know, you have to be very wary of any sort of health and diet trend. When anyone tells you that something is a superfood, it is an entirely meaningless term. The European Union has actually banned the use of the word superfood in marketing because it's complete and utter BS. And I think Dr. Oz, someone who touts superfoods and you know, foods that are incredibly healthy for you, and this is the miracle food and this is the miracle diet, I was testifying in front of, you know, the Senate, a Senate hearing the other day, for you know, basically false advertising of diet claims and different programs. But they're very powerful because, you know, there's an epidemic of obesity and poor eating in this country. And people are very afraid. They don't know what to eat. They want to know what they should eat. Is it chia seeds? Is it blueberries? Is it margarine or is it butter? Should I be having coconut oil or should it be chicken breast or maybe it's chicken thighs? We don't know. And it's so confusing. And the science, you know, is still trying to come to terms with what's good for us and what isn't, that within that confusion, you get opportunities for people to exploit those fears and sell us, you know, snake oil.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why foods like, I don't know, quinoa or kale or others that were being touted as being superfoods, why they became so popular?
Exactly. I mean, there's practical reasons around them. You know, these if you have kale and quinoa and you're cooking it, it's good for you. It's not going to be bad for you unless it's the only thing you eat. And, you know, kale has its practical advantages. It stays better in the fridge longer than spinach. You know, spinach turns into a slimy mess in 3 days. Kale can sit there for weeks, and you're like, oh, gosh, kale, of course, I have this. I'll turn it into a salad now. I'll make it into a stir fry or whatever. But I think it's when you get – what happens is when people take that and they say, okay, great, now we're going to make a Snickers bar with quinoa in it, or we're going to do, you know, a kale juice Snapple, now with antioxidants. You know, there was a product a couple years ago called 7-Up Antioxidant Berry. It was regular 7-Up with, you know, a drop of fruit juice in it. But yes, fruit juice has antioxidants because antioxidants are what give fruits and vegetables their pigments. And so, yeah, could you call it Antioxidant Berry? Sure, you know, you could. But the Federal Trade Commission and a class action lawsuit basically made them take that product off the shelves because it was snake oil. There's nothing different from that than, you know, the health tonics of 100 years ago. And so it gets very dangerous. It gets confusing, and it's a way of just, you know, using buzzwords to sell something. But if you're generally cooking stuff from scratch and using fresh ingredients, then, you know, it's not going to be harmful. But if don't think that just because you eat a lot of kale, it's going to, you know, give you the cure for cancer. If that was the case, we would have patented it long ago.
Lynn in Coloma has what Wisconsin considers a superfood on her mind. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I think bratwurst is to Wisconsin and to the Midwest one of God's gifts. And when I go to Wautoma to my grocery store, there's 25 to maybe 30, 50 different brands, or not brands, but types of homemade bratwurst that you can choose from. And I just think it's a wonderful thing. Back in Illinois, before we retired to Wisconsin, our beloved Dominick's, which is now gone, was taken over by a California company. And they got rid of all Johnsonville products and all bratwursts. And the hue and cry that went up at the Dominick's store was like, what are you thinking?
Yeah. Well, where do sausages fall in the world of food trends, David, or bratwurst?
It's interesting. You know, I think it's, you can have, as much as there are big trends that are national and international, like cupcakes or Greek yogurt, what you see now in this world of food trends is people, it's made everybody, your average American, more and more conscious about the food they eat and more interested in the food they eat. Everybody watches the Food Network. Everybody is a foodie in some sense or another today. We're no longer just blindly going to the store and buying one brand of frozen bratwurst. We want more variety, and because of that, we want things, whether they're local specialties like bratwurst or, you know, Wisconsin cheese, or things that are sort of national like cupcakes. Yeah, we want options. We want choice. We want innovation around it. And so you'll get, you know, 20 varieties of bratwurst where 15 years ago you could probably only get, you know, just your standard Johnsonville brats or whatever there was in the area. And so that's I think is the benefit of food trends. As much as we may say, gosh, it's really annoying, you know, with all these flavors of Greek yogurt. Imagine a world without food trends. You know, we would have far less choice and far less innovation. And food trends would allow people to start food businesses, to innovate, to hire new people and take risks as entrepreneurs and really to try to introduce us to new flavors and ideas that that not only have benefits economically, but they also have benefits culturally. They expand our minds. Think about a product like Sriracha hot sauce. This obscure Thai hot sauce, which in the past couple of years has grown up to be this huge American trend. It's a condiment now on par with salsa. I mean, I was at a hotel in Portland, Oregon, and, you know, they put out the Tabasco and the Sriracha right next to each other on the table when I had breakfast.
Right.
And so that pulls in Thai food and Southeast Asian cooking to something that we all might try and we all might be willing to sort of experiment with, and it broadens our horizon,
which I think
is ultimately only a positive thing.
And David, we just have a couple of minutes, and I didn't get to one of the biggest ones, at least that I've seen. Why is it that everything is better with bacon? I mean, why do we put bacon in our ice cream?
Well, this is a good question for, you know, a bacon loving state, I think, like Wisconsin. Bacon, the bacon trend is a really interesting thing because it is a food trend that actually the pork industry was the one that really sort of pushed. When the low fat trend was happening, nobody wanted bacon and pork belly prices were, you know, pennies on the dollar. And so the pork industry pushed through their marketing to get fast food chains and other restaurant chains to put bacon on sandwiches. And it succeeded in creating this taste for bacon that people then saw, you know, this will create excitement around any product. There is a love for this. And because there is, you know, it became a movement in its own right where what can we put bacon into? How many strips of bacon can we put into this dish? You know, bacon in its core is salty and fatty and filled with protein and yet some sweetness. And so it hits at all these things that the human body craves in terms of taste. And it just becomes a vehicle for selling.
Look, less than 30 seconds. Are you watching some food item as the next big thing?
I really think in the next couple of years you're going to see sort of black rice appearing in a lot of high-end restaurants and working its way down. You know, fast food, mainstream Indian food. I think Indian food will go from kind of Indian areas and South Asian areas of cities to something that we have as commonly as Sriracha.
Ooh, I think I can get on board that train. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
David Sachs is author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Thanks to Justin Williams, Christy Taylor, and Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.